From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. For a third day in a row, President Trump tweeted insults at four Democratic freshman congresswomen of color, calling them pro-terrorists, insisting his own tweets about them are not racist, and claiming that Democratic Party leaders are afraid of their political power. Texas Senator Ted Cruz echoed that message on Fox News this morning.
The speaker has handed her gavel over to those freshmen. The committee chairs have handed their gavels over to the freshmen, and every one of them are terrified that these freshmen will criticize them.
Well, tonight, House Democrats will vote on a resolution condemning President Trump's racist tweets about the congresswoman, and Trump told Republicans to vote against it. Joining us now is NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is expected with this resolution when it comes up for a vote this evening? Are any Republicans going to vote for it?
Well, Republican leaders came to the microphones this morning and essentially were completely against it, saying that they didn't think that what the president said was racist, and in fact, what they were what Democrats were trying to do was distract from the policies of the four congresswomen who the president had originally attacked in his tweet. So. They're trying to keep their troops in line. It will be interesting to see if any of them wind up crossing over.
What about for Trump and Republicans? Does it help them to keep this fight going? Does it distract from other things like the fact that those raids that President Trump promised didn't happen over the weekend in the way that he said that they would, or even the Jeffrey Epstein story from last week, which, you know, brought down the Secretary of Labor?
Yeah, I think that what the president here is trying to do is make these four congresswomen the face of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. You've seen them. You've seen, the president. You've seen Republicans in the past try to take extreme parts of one thing or another and say that that is the entirety of the party. You know, they've done grayed out, you know, scary looking imagery of Nancy Pelosi of all kinds of ads. And it's kind of ironic given how often she was used as a San Francisco liberal, mm-hmm. quote unquote, as a lightning rod for so many of these congressional races because her favorability ratings were so poor in those swing districts and tried to use her in those places that now the people who she's winding up, you know, having disagreement with over tactics and some ideology that they're now resorting to using these newer women who also happen to be women of color. It's an interesting shift in how Republicans have now decided to take this fight in a different direction.
Well, one of these congresswomen is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who tweeted right back at President Trump this morning. And yesterday, this is what she said about the president's call for critics of his to leave the country.
The first note that I want to tell children across this country is that no matter what the president says, this country belongs to you. And it belongs to everyone.
Domenico, their news conference yesterday aired nationally. Are they more powerful now than they were before?
It's hard to say. You know, I mean, they weren't exactly on the same page yesterday completely. You had Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts say that they shouldn't take the bait. And instead, then you had Congresswoman Ilhan Omar come out later and essentially slam the president every which way and say that he should be impeached, which is exactly what Republicans and the president want Democrats to be saying. And this is not a moralistic argument here. This is a political, raw, clear-eyed, strategic thing that they're trying to say because they look at the polling that says that a majority of the country doesn't want impeachment proceedings to begin. Republicans and the president and his reelection campaign think that that's advantageous for them. Whether or not it plays out that way is a separate issue, but they feel like they were able to make them take the bait, completely after that press conference. But, you know, they were able to have their message out there, were able to talk about it, and frankly, there's potentially a gift that Trump has given Democrats with this because Nancy Pelosi and the four congresswomen their quote unquote feud is not what's dominating, but President Trump's racist tweets are.
Now, one of the four congresswomen, as you mentioned, is Ilhan Omar. Now, Democrats did not censure her by name when she was criticized a few months ago for making anti-Semitic remarks. But Trump yesterday falsely accused Omar of praising al-Qaeda and more. Do you expect more misrepresentation of what these women are saying? Because, of course, she hasn't praised al-Qaeda.
Well, this is politics. So, you know, there is going to be all kinds of spin on, you know, all of these issues from here until Election Day, because, you know, President Trump expects that this is going to be a very, very close election and they're going to pull out every stop.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Thanks.
You're so welcome.
Well, to a disturbing report from the WHO, the World Health Organization, cases of adult abuse are expected to increase. Most states have hotlines to report abuse or exploitation of a senior or an adult with a disability. But in Missouri, a recent investigation by Public Radio's KBIA and the Columbia Missourian showed that many of the calls made to the state's adult abuse hotline last year were lost. Aviva Okeson-Haberman reports.
Adult Abuse and Neglect Hotline.
At Missouri's Adult Abuse Hotline call center in Jefferson City, employees sit in cubicles, answering phones and typing up reports for every call. From 7 a.m. to midnight, the workers answer calls about everything from reports of physical or sexual abuse to financial exploitation and self-neglect. Preston Nilges points to his computer screen, which shows what each of today's nine workers is doing.
And then you also see two of them are currently talking on the phone.
So right now, there's no one available. If someone were to call in, they would be waiting right now.
That's correct, because some people are working on their previous reports that they just received.
Workers have to complete the paperwork on a call before they answer the next call. Nilges says he's seen an increase in calls in the 2 years he's worked at the hotline.
It can get a little stressful because we do see how many calls are coming in. We have a max out call, and so it is a little stressful, but, you know, we try to get them as fast as we can.
That max out call means if more than four people are on hold, the next caller is dropped. From January to April this year, about 9,000 calls have been dropped, according to data from a public records request. Catherine Sapp oversees policy for Missouri's Adult Protective Services.
And that is my big fear, is we're losing folks because of, oh, they couldn't get through.
People are going to start giving up.
That's Samantha Ferguson-Knight. She's the director of senior programming at Kingdom House, a social services organization in St. Louis. When she called the hotline in late April, her call was dropped. Over the course of a day and a half, she called back 11 times and was on hold for a total of 2 hours.
Have you ever been on hold with a bill collector or someone that's that's trying to take your time and you call and you wait and you wait and wait? Most people generally give up.
Here's what callers to the hotline hear when they're on hold.
All agents are currently busy assisting other callers. Please hold and your call will be answered in the order it was received. Thank you for your patience.
The average hold time is more than 8 minutes, but some people wait more than an hour to speak to someone. Not everyone has experienced these problems. And when we called, it took us a little less than 6 minutes to get through. But if you add up the number of callers who were dropped and who hung up, you get a staggering statistic. Only half of the 92,000 calls to the adult abuse hotline were answered last year. Jessica Bax took over as director for Missouri's Division of Senior and Disability Services about a year ago. She says the division didn't realize there were issues with the hotline until late 2018 when they heard complaints.
There's been a lack of good data in the past, coupled with an increase in need that has led us to a point where we have to address a problem.
Back says data before 2018 didn't include dropped or disconnected calls. This resulted in an inaccurate picture of how many people use the hotline and how it operates. Nationally, states vary in how they operate their hotlines. Missouri, like most states, doesn't have a way for people to report abuse online. Some states like California and South Carolina handle reports at a county level, and almost half of states have workers available to take reports of abuse 24/7. Back says nationally, there are no federal requirements for adult protective services.
The reason there are no actual federal requirements is because there's no federal funding for adult protective services, and that's not the same as for child protective services.
States can use federal money from the Social Services Block Grant, but Bill Benson says the lack of a dedicated funding stream shows an apathy to addressing elder abuse. He's the national policy advisor at the National Adult Protective Services Association.
The gap between what would be a reasonable response or what would be a good response and what we have today is just gigantic. It's gigantic. And what it says is that elder abuse is not a priority for this nation at this time and its policymakers.
In Missouri, the state attorney general recently launched an investigation into the hotline after he heard the findings of KBIA and the Columbia Missourians reporting. Jessica Back says her division will first address inefficiencies in the hotline before requesting state funding for additional workers. This includes decreasing the length of time workers spend writing up reports of abuse or neglect, which could free them to answer more calls. For Here and Now, I'm Aviva Okeson-Haberman.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
And now we'll look at one of the most common health problems. It can affect men and children, but it mainly affects women. And when I say its name, many will wince. It's a urinary tract infection, burning pain, general discomfort, but an infection that antibiotics once cured pretty quickly. Now, that's not always the case. According to recent reporting in the New York Times, many UTIs have become resistant to antibiotics, so much so that hospitalizations are on the rise. One city has an app for doctors to help track strains of infection and drugs that cure them. And the cause of UTIs is expanding. It's often foodborne. E. coli from chicken is often the cause. Dr. Jessica Shepherd specializes in women's health at Baylor University Medical Center in Texas. She's also founder of Her Viewpoint, an online women's health forum. So, Dr. Shepherd, start with basics. Ladies, we know we need to keep the private parts clean. Like your mother said, wipe front to back, keep bacteria away. Give us some of the basics.
Yeah, you know, what we see in women typically is that they actually will have more urinary tract infections than males. And that's because just the anatomy of the urethra, and it has a little bit more access, I guess you can say, to the outside world than you would see in the male anatomy. Mm-hmm. So what we are seeing is, one, in pregnancy is another reason why you'd see more urinary tract infections as well. So many times it is due to something that was acquired, you know, in the genitourinary tract area. But now that we're seeing something that could be foodborne, especially when it comes to E. coli, can be a very big issue, because that's something that we really haven't encountered before. Mm-hmm. And now looking at the treatments for that, that's where we have some of the issues.
Yeah, so be aware that you know, now could possibly get a UTI from E. coli from chicken, for instance. So that's new for many women. But it always has been treated by drugs. And now we're reading so many of these infections are resistant to the two most common drugs, ampicillin and Bactrim.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, some of the things that we've noticed since, I guess you can say, since the advent of penicillin, say, is that we typically know when there's an infection in a certain part of the body, we know what antibiotics are going to do really well with that infection, what's going to help clear them up. So now we're running into the issue, not only of how you get the urinary tract infection, is how you actually treat it. And so what we're finding is what we call a antibiotic resistance. And so that really encounters when we have antibiotics that are typical for treating a typical infection that's not working. And what we're seeing now is that as we start to have different types of urinary tract infections, is now we're not having the antibiotics to cover those. And that's where we're incurring more of a problem in what we're seeing more women being admitted to the hospital or having more severe urinary tract infections that can go all the way up to the kidney.
And we understand that one way of finding out which drug for sure will effectively treat the infection you have is a culture. You know, you grow the bacteria, find out what it is, but that can take time.
Absolutely, and that's the difference between being able to treat when someone comes into the office with symptoms, or even if you do something as savvy as telemedicine and having those characteristic symptoms of a urinary tract infection. The issue now is, even if we do treat those over the phone, sending in a prescription for the patient, we can't get very good coverage because these antibiotics are not covering the urinary tract infection. So you had said something earlier about the bacteria changing, and bacteria are actually very smart. And so when they have an antibiotic that they have that can, you know, push away that infection, when we have too many people who are taking antibiotics that are not for the intended use that it is, that's when bacteria can actually change its coding and therefore be resistant to the antibiotics that we use.
Yeah. So perhaps take a culture so you can be sure that you're getting a drug that matches the strain of the infection that you have. And in the meantime, the New York Health Department is so concerned about this resistance, they've got a new mobile app that gives doctors and nurses access to the lists of strains of UTIs and the drugs they're resistant to. Maybe that will actually go wider.
You know, that's a great thing to have an app. That's a great use of technology, because what we're running into now is that it's not the typical bacteria that's going to cause a urinary tract infection. And we need to treat these people very quickly before it becomes something that's so severe that we're going to have more hospital admissions, more ER visits. And that's where we really need to make sure that we're taking care of the patient adequately.
Well, when you talk about hospital visits, there are women who are ending up in the hospital with this infection going to their kidneys.
And even further, it can go beyond the kidneys. You know, we can have someone who can go into sepsis who is not treated adequately for a simple urinary tract infection. So imagine someone having a urinary tract infection, having common symptoms, but the bacteria is not being covered by the antibiotic and it just gets a little bit worse. And that's what we need to be careful about, is that we're having hospital admissions that are now turning into sepsis. And that's going to even cause more antibiotic coverage and then patient safety.
Okay, and so, you know, try to keep the area free of bacteria if you can. And now we understand foodborne E. coli is also a major cause. But also know that we read it once again in the New York Times article, cranberry juice is just not going to do the trick.
That is not the cure for UTIs. We want to make sure that people are hydrating themselves. Cranberry juice actually has a lot of sugar, which can actually increase the risk of having a urinary tract infection.
Okay. That's Dr. Jessica Shepherd. She focuses on women's health at Baylor Medical Center in Texas. Dr. Shepherd, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Nora O'Donnell made her debut as anchor of the CBS Evening News last night.
This is the CBS Evening News with Nora O'Donnell.
Good evening. It's good to be with you.
The veteran journalist takeover of the program is one of many moves by CBS News President Susan Zirinsky to revive the network, which has struggled against competitors despite its legacy as the home of pioneering journalists like Walter Cronkite and Mike Wallace. For more, let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, let's start with Nora O'Donnell. She was most recently on the CBS This Morning. How are people reacting to her first night in the anchor's chair in the evening?
Well, she's was before that an experienced political reporter. I first met her in the late 90s during the late Clinton years. And I think CBS wanted to trade on that seriousness of purpose that she presents. And I think it was received in that way. I think people thought this was a substantive, strong first broadcast. You know, people were looking, for example, the question of how would she handle the president's tweets and the criticism of it. I think she was the first at CBS News on her own authority to call the tweets racist, which was a debate playing out in newsrooms across the country. They also had substantive stories about the president's past record, troubling record on race, about the question of ICE raids, about other things, including not only the question of the 50th anniversary of man landing on the moon, but a lot of the women mathematicians and physicists involved in getting him there. And so I thought it, you know, was top to bottom a pretty strong you know, corporate national newscast.
Now, this is not the first time in the last many years that CBS Evening News has had a new anchor. Just listen to this. This is just since Dan Rather, who left the program in 2005.
For the CBS Evening News, Dan Rather reporting.
Good evening. I'm Bob Schieffer.
Katie Couric. Tonight, it was...
This is the CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley.
This is the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glore.
It's amazing to listen to all that just since 2005. Why has there been so much turnover on that show?
A lot of turnover. I think that after Dan Rather, in the era where his peers were Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, when anchors were expected to last decades, that hasn't been the case. And there's been a lot of self-inflicted wounds over at CBS. The real issue has been ratings and tension over those ratings. Scott Pelley, you know, seemed to stabilize things a bit, as Bob Schieffer had after the departure of Dan Rather. You had 5 years of Katie Couric. People often forget that. And she started a little rocky and people didn't seem prepared to accept her. And I got to say, I thought she really ended up holding her own by the end. But she was ready to go and they were ready for her to be gone. She was also a different model where she was paid, you know, well over $15 million a year. That's not where CBS is financially and that's not where it wants to be. So as the ratings have still remained lagging behind that of their peers at NBC and ABC, they've wanted to find another formula, less expensive, but also one that can project things. And let's say one other thing. Nora O'Donnell is attempted to be a corrective not only of the question of ratings, but the question of an era where, you know, CBS just went through these terrible scandals with Charlie Rose and then the executive producer of the executive producer of 60 Minutes, Jeff Fager, and Les Moonves, the chairman of and CEO of CBS Network itself. They want to project that there's somebody of – they keep saying the word integrity, and I think that's what they're trying to project.
But as they look at the competition right now on the broadcast networks with Lester Holt at NBC and David Muir at ABC, and they're behind. They start – you know, she starts out behind in the ratings. Is the evening news on TV – kind of a dying industry at this point?
You know, in some ways, it's something of a loss leader. It's a way of branding the network. It's a way of leading into a lot of their local stations, a decent number of which are owned by the parent companies of the networks. And so they want those stations to have pretty strong lead-ins in their local news, which is a way in which they often make a fair amount of money. It's a way of planting a flag and helping to identify the network with a single face and voice. But the morning shows make a lot more money, far more money than the evening shows do. And for CBS, you know, for NBC, it's the Today Show. For ABC, it's Good Morning America. For CBS, they've made some really good inroads, or at least they did for a while when Charlie Rose was paired with Gayle King and Nora O'Donnell. But their flagship news show is actually 60 Minutes, which makes them a good chunk of change. So CBS is lagging in the money and it's lagging in the evening news ratings. Together, the three big networks managed to get a little over 20 million people. That's not something to sneeze at, but it's a lot less than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to take a listen to what O'Donnell said in her sign-off last night. You know, she's a serious journalist, as you've said, and she invoked Edward R. Murrow, who in the 1950s ushered CBS into the golden age of television. Here she is.
There's a great legacy here at CBS News of the finest journalists. One of them was Edward R. Murrow, who eloquently captured the power of television when he said, "This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, yes, and even it can inspire."
But it can Murrow do O'Donnell, so only to the last night signing off there. So we'll see what happens now with the CBS Evening News. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Facebook headed to the Hill today to defend Libra, the new cryptocurrency it hopes to launch next year. But so far, Facebook has hit a wall of bipartisan resistance. President Trump, Fed Chair Jerome Powell, Democratic Representative Maxine Waters, and others have all raised red flags. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Robin.
And let's listen first. Facebook executive David Marcus testified before the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs this morning. Here he is making his case for Libra.
Imagine a daughter who wants to send money home to her mom in another country. Of the $200 she sends, $14 on average will be lost because of fees. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Okay, so refresh us. You know, how does normal money transfer work? How would Libra theoretically solve this.
So what a lot of people who have bank accounts and use things like PayPal or Venmo don't understand is that, A, there's a large population in the United States that is unbanked. They don't have a bank account. And if you don't have a bank account or a credit card, you can't link those payment systems to anything. And there are a lot of countries in the world where credit cards can't be used for transfers overseas or for making purchases, places like Russia or Nigeria or Iran. So there is an audience for this, and Facebook has probably better tentacles into, you know, people in these countries than anyone else. So on one hand, there's a need for it, and then there is some sense that cryptocurrencies do a lot. They're efficient, they're low cost, they're easy ways to transact. There are concerns on the other side, though, that it is an unregulated industry to start with. Facebook is an unregulated thing, and we have been facing lots of problems with fake news and data usage with Facebook. So if you're going to start an unregulated cryptocurrency, there are politicians and critics who are saying maybe Facebook hasn't got the track record to be the group to start this.
Right. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said yesterday it could be misused by, you know, terrorist financiers. Others are worried, as you said, about the loss of data because Facebook has done that before. But just can you explain to me, I mean, if other systems charge fees to transfer money and people are unbanked, they're not in those systems, would Libra not charge a fee? I mean, what is Facebook making money?
So they call it low to no cost, right? The point with Facebook is sort of like Apple. Get as many people into your ecosystem as possible. So Facebook makes money because they have people's data. If they get that much more data about what people are buying and where they're transferring money, they sell that to advertisers. So Facebook makes money coming and going. The reason you can lower fees is because in a normal world where, as the Treasury Secretary says, you're monitoring transactions to see whether they're going to people on restricted lists or for terrorists or drugs or things like that, that takes human intervention. Cryptocurrencies don't use human intervention.
Right.
They use algorithms and servers and computers. That's why they can move money at lower costs at no fee.
Right.
So the concern about it being used for nefarious purposes is real. That's not just about Libra. That's about any cryptocurrency.
Well, and just about, you know, privacy breaches, which Facebook has had. Here's Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat from Ohio, in exchange with Facebook's David Marcus.
Do you trust this enough to make your compensation paid fully in your currency?
Senator, I would, because it is backed one for one with a reserve.
You could have said yes at the beginning of the question then.
Okay, so a little tension there. What do you think is going to happen here? Because people are saying they're going to pass something to block this.
I think as we go on in time, we will see cryptocurrencies. And once we have figured out how to regulate them, we'll probably have less concern about Facebook. I'm not sure Facebook is going to get this thing up and running in a year because of the pushback it faces.
Okay. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, will follow the story of Libra. Thank you.
Bye.
Gay men need to be feminists, too. That's the headline of an LA Times column by Rich Benjamin, the author of the book Searching for Whitopia. He says feminists have been a big part of the progress in LGBTQ rights over the last many decades, and that gay men need to now stand up for women's rights in the workplace and society. Rich Benjamin joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
Doing well. And let me ask you, what spurred you to write about this issue, this topic?
During the lead up to Pride Month this June, Jeremy, I began to feel an ambivalence, an unsettledness, and I wondered why, And finally, I put my finger on it. It felt kind of weird to celebrate gay male liberation, to celebrate Pride, when women were having such a ferocious backslide in their rights. And so that inspired me to look more deeply at that. What can gay men do to step up our support for women, especially given what they've done for our movement and what they've done for our cause over so many decades?
Well, and give us a sense of what you're talking about there, how important feminists have been and women have been in the fight for gay rights.
Feminists have been crucial, from lesbian groups like the Daughters of Bilitis to notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Feminists have stood by us. They have marched on our behalf. They were there during HIV and AIDS. They were there during marriage equality, not just in the state and in the courts, but just as allies in our day-to-day lives.
And you feel that gay men are not doing the same for women now?
I worry that about that very much. I worry that now that gay men have been embraced in terms of marriage equality and to some extent child adoption rights, I don't think that necessarily increases our alliance with women. It could, in fact, strengthen our bond to entitled straight men. And so I think that there is a backsliding among gay men into what our duty and what our alliance with feminists are. And Jeremy, I had an interesting experiment. I posted on Twitter a poll. Who do you think at this point in history is more sexist? Straight men, gay men, or they're both equally sexist? Mm. And 38% responded that they believe straight men are more sexist. 4% responded they believed gay men are more sexist. And a whopping 58% said that gay and straight men are equally sexist. Hmm.
Do you have an example of that?
Of gay male sexism? Mm-hmm. Well, we have plenty of examples of straight male sexism starting at the White House. But examples of gay male sexism have to do with how we treat women in the workplace. They have to do with have gay men internalized our own misogyny and our own unconscious bias in how we prefer men and give men a leg up, not only in simple everyday interactions, but in terms of pay equity, in terms of the things that matter into the current feminist movement. And not only are we more sexist, but do we have a proactive role in helping women in terms of how are women fighting for minimum wage? How are immigrant women fighting for their very dignity? How are reproductive rights being rolled back? So it's not just our sexism. It's are we being proactive enough given what women have done for us?
Are you being self-reflective as you think about this? Do you think that you've been sexist yourself?
Oh, yes, yes. You know, I'm not one to give a bromide and get all self-righteous on everybody else as though I'm not implicated in all this. I do. And this essay began from a point of self-reflection during Pride. You know, what am I marching for? Who's being left out of the march? Who, you know, does my liberation come at someone else's expense? Or at least do I feel as though I'm doing as much for others as for my own people? In this case, gay men.
One of the big issues, obviously, when it comes to women's rights right now is with abortion rights. And there are big questions now with the Supreme Court about what will happen on that front. However, gay men are the least likely people in this country to have to deal with the issue of abortion personally. But you say they should get involved in that fight.
I think so. And I say that because for me, abortion has to do with self-determination of the body. It has to do with rights. It has to do with stigma-free health care and access to stigma-free health care. And I think that touches gay men. Now, feminists understand that, but gay men don't always empathize with women and see the flip side, you know, because we're generally not getting women pregnant. We are not dealing with unwanted pregnancies. But at the same time, it is our cause very much, and it very much has to do with us.
You are African American. Do you feel the same way about, let's say, blacks and Latinos in this country who both face discrimination, both have significant hurdles to overcome? Are those groups working together as much as they should?
To be honest, no. I think we could do more. I think everyone on the progressive side could do more, especially when we see the treatment of migrants who are black but more often than not tend to be from Central American origin and Mexican origin. I think we can do better in supporting each other, black and brown, LGBTQ and women. I think, Jeremy, we're going to be in a fight for our lives, and I think things are going to get worse before they get better. And as people, women, LGBT, black and brown, we can no longer rely on the state for our rights as we typically did. We can no longer rely on the Supreme Court and the federal courts to protect us. we should not give up on the state. We should certainly, you know, defend ourselves fiercely through the state. But we have to be more inventive and creative, and we have to turn up for each other. We have to go to the mat for one another. And to your question, yeah, I think it applies to black and brown people too.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to your column?
I've gotten some gratitude from women. I got some gratitude from heterosexual women who said, wow, I've been thinking about this, but I didn't have the words to put on it, and I didn't feel it was my place to publicly call gay men out. That's one reaction, is gratitude from gay women. And I got some other reflection and soul-searching from gay men saying, I'm not necessarily political. My professional life isn't in politics, but I do think of the women in my personal life who've helped me along the way, who've been very important to my own sense of liberation. And I've never thought about this in the way that you have. And then I got a little crankiness from gay men saying, why are we always being called out? Why are we? And it was just a general unwillingness to look at their implicit complicity with sexism in this country.
And what did you say back to them?
I said, you better check yourself. I said, this is a read. Because it really is there. I'm not making this up. I'm asking women who are deeply involved professionally with gay men and straight men. And they say they see very similar patterns of misogyny among gay men as straight men. Now, gay men aren't passing anti-abortion laws, but that doesn't mean we're not complicit in a lot of the sexism in terms of pay, in terms of workplace equality, in terms of unconscious bias that women face.
That is Rich Benjamin, who is the author of Searching for Whitetopia, and we will link you to his column about the idea that gay men should be feminists too at hereandnow.org. Rich, thanks for joining us.
You got it, Jeremy. Thank you.
One note about today, because this is the 50th anniversary of a milestone for the United States and for humankind. On July 16, 1969, Apollo 11 blasted off for the moon from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida with three astronauts on board: Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins. Neil Armstrong, who took the first steps on the moon, died in 2012. But today, astronaut Michael Collins returned to Launch Complex 39A to mark the moment of liftoff, 9:32 a.m.
We know by now there is too much plastic in the ocean, 13 million tons of it, killing wildlife, polluting waters. We know this. But Emily Penn is one of those people who's decided to do something about it. She's co-founder of Expedition, and for the last 8 years, she's been leading remote global explorations. This October, she'll take 300 women in shifts on a 2-year trip around the world to study plastic pollution, a trip paid for by the women and corporate sponsors. Emily Penn joins us now from the UK. And Emily, you'll have scientists, teachers, journalists. Why all female?
So it began all female because when I investigated in my own blood whether I was getting these chemicals from the ocean and pollution inside us, it turned out that, in fact, I did have these toxic chemicals inside me. And the general impact of those chemicals are their hormone disruptors, particularly for us women. It's really bad news getting a lot of those chemicals inside our body. So I thought, why not tackle it with an amazing team of women? And it started from there, and it's just had such a positive impact and a really powerful mission when we're at sea with this group of women that we've carried on.
Well, first of all, how do you test your blood? How do you do that?
You take a blood test and they actually look at the polluting chemicals, things that shouldn't be in your body, things like pesticides and flame retardants, and find out what's there that shouldn't be.
And you saw that. You saw plastics. Because we know that plastics become these little micro parts like plankton, and, you know, they can get into our systems in so many different ways, the same way they get into the wildlife in the sea. You could see it registered plastics in your blood?
So actually not plastics, it's other polluting chemicals, some that are used in the production of plastic and others that are just in our world because we have all these synthetic chemicals that we use in our daily lives.
Yeah. And by the way, speaking of misperceptions of what this impact is, for a while we talked about this floating island of plastics and people think that it's like a mountain and you can see like bottles sticking out of it. When you're out on the water, what is the sense of plastics?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I first went out there 10 years ago expecting to find this island. But as you say, it's really not the reality. What we find is more like a soup, because we've got to keep in mind that the ocean covers 70% of our planet. And it's huge. It takes us a week or two just once we've set sail to actually get to this accumulation zone. And when we arrive, we see a piece of plastic there, over there, maybe every 10 seconds passing the boat. But what's really alarming is when we put the trawl through the water, this very fine mesh net, and we pull it out, we actually realize that there are just in our hands, hundreds of fragments that are smaller than your fingernail. And it makes us realize that actually there's this fine soup of microplastic covering the surface.
Well, Emily, this is something we already know. So I guess I'm getting a little frustrated about plastics in the ocean. And it sounds wonderful and noble that you're making this trip. But why make the trip to see the thing you already know is there?
Absolutely. So now you're right. It's all about action. And so we need a couple of things now to actually make change on this issue that we all care about. One of those is to further understand where this plastic is coming from. Because at the moment, we're not certain, is it microfibers from our clothing? Is it tire dust from our vehicles? Is it pre-production pellets that haven't even got into a consumer's hand? So we need to understand what plastic is there and where it's coming from so that we can work out on land where to prevent it getting into the ocean. So that's certainly one aim. But we also need to communicate this story, the fact that we need to be solving it on land. And we need change makers, these women who've been out there and seen this issue firsthand so that they probably understand the problem and therefore their role in solving it when they get back home. And what we need is an entire army of people working on solving this problem back on land.
Would we know some of the women? Because we know there's scientists, teachers, filmmakers. I mean, would we know them?
Certainly a lot of the women on board are well known in their fields, but at the same time, they're also women that we can really relate to. And it's about sort of saying, actually, we all have a part to play.
But meantime, just quickly, you were an architect and are now an ocean advocate.
Absolutely. I trained as an architect. I really wanted to design buildings. When I was 21, I had a job lined up in Australia and decided to hitchhike by boat from England to Australia because I didn't want to get on an aeroplane. And I ended up crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean and came across this plastic 1,000 miles from nearest land. And it didn't make any sense to me. And that's why I've spent the last 12 years working on solutions to solve it.
Well, good for you. That's Emily Penn, co-founder of Expedition 2X's. And this October, she's going to be taking an all-female crew on a 2-year voyage around the world to look at the impact of ocean plastics. Emily, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
No problem. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.